is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the Hollow Earth, live from the Grillion Bunker, welcome again once and all. Or one and all, I should say, to the one and only Grillion Report. Glad to be here with you, as always. I'm the mouth of the South, Micah Hanks, fresh back from Denver, Colorado. You'll be hearing all about that here in mere moments. But first, I bid you greetings. Welcome back down here to the dark disquiet known as the Mohorovicic discontinuity. I'm afraid that won't be the last time you're going to hear that word, probably tonight. As in hour two, we delve into inner earth mysteries, one of the most creepy, if entirely speculative. Well, maybe not entirely speculative, actually. I mean, there's a lot to this discussion that I think has bearing on reality. The speculation that comes into what are known to exist underground, which are cavernous systems that traverse the continental United States. We, of course, have, you know, deep underground. We have oceans, all kinds of mineral, and maybe the likelihood of different various kinds of extremophilia, that is, animal varieties that exist in extreme locations. Maybe could they live underground without sunlight? Things like this have actually been proven in the past. We've got little kinds of critters and doodads and things that crop up around volcanic vents beneath the ocean. Last place you'd expect to find life. Maybe there are things that exist deep beneath us, the likes of which none of us can comprehend. We'll talk about that possibility in hour two, but with a particularly creepy bent as we are entering the months, or I'm sorry, actually, the end of this month and then the full month leading up to the end of next month, which happens to be one of my favorite holidays, Halloween, the Halloween season. I always get so excited this time of the year. I'm sure you do too. And hence you're here listening to the creepy. And I'll tell you what's creepy. As a matter of fact, what could be creepier than going out for a day on the beach? You wouldn't want to go outside scantily clad today here in Asheville, North Carolina. A bit brisk, the weather. But visitors from outer space may have actually been visiting a beach in Sydney, Australia. Now, locals in the area known as DY on the city's north shore were reporting seeing a large number of strange objects that had washed ashore. I'm looking at a photo of these things right now. This looks like something out of an episode of The Muppet Show. But rather than green spheres being something from another planet, scientists said that these things, which some people were calling alien eggs, may have been a variety of sponge-like seaweed that forms an egg shape, possibly to protect itself from predators. Now, very interestingly, this beach was covered in these little round, spongy balls of seaweed. Beachgoers said they'd never seen anything quite like it. But again, they were described as alien hairballs, alien eggs, and of course, UFOs, unidentified floating objects. Now, about 3 days ago, there were a few egg-shaped balls, but as of today, there were many more of them, and they were bigger. I remember a few years ago a video, speaking of things underground, these of course being underwater, but there's underwater underground, so hence why they call it underwater, but well, you know what I'm saying. Semantic games aside, there was a video that showed up online that was reportedly filmed here in North Carolina. And what it showed were these weird brain-like globs. We had this video posted up on GrailianReport.com, and these brain-like globs were seen by this camera that was shooting through a little pipe system beneath a, it was basically a sewer system underneath a little shopping mall, if I remember correctly. And as this camera would approach these brain-like masses, they would move by themselves, and it was the grossest thing you can imagine. But there are actually different kinds of organisms that will join together in this manner, and they will act kind of as a community of what appears to be at times one organism. These were believed to be worms, but there are different kinds of cells and things like this that will do this, and it can seem quite nasty. They'll form in the bases of creeks and rivers. They'll form in pipe systems and things like this. Life. Boy, I always, when I'm talking about this sort of a thing, I always come back to Dr. Ian Malcolm. Fictional character, wise though he was, as time has shown yet again, that life does find a way, doesn't it? In other news right now, this is one that's got a few people slightly concerned. National Guard officials have confirmed that three soldiers from the Afghan National Army have apparently gone missing from Joint Base, not the one in Charleston, the one in Cape Cod. This was reported recently by WFXT Television in Boston. Now, Major Jan Mohammed Arash, Captain Mohammed Nasir Akzarda, and also Captain Rulia Amyanyar, who were on the base for training exercises, were reported missing by base security Saturday night. They have not been seen since. Now, according to a spokesperson, Lieutenant Colonel James Shahadi, he says that there is no indication that these three men pose a threat to the public. But I have to say, as is obvious by their names, the three soldiers, now missing, along with 12 other members of the Afghan National Army, were taking part in a tactical strategies joint exercise that involved only officers and senior enlisted personnel. Now, six countries, including the U.S., are participating in activities scheduled for completion by Wednesday. All participants were vetted by U.S. Central Command and not restricted to the base. The three soldiers arrived in the United States, however, on a rather poignant date, that of September 11th. They were last spotted, the three men, Saturday night at the Cape Cod Mall. So where have these three men gone? It's going to be an interesting story. We'll be following that one here, of course, as our awareness is continually heightened here in the bunker. I'll tell you, you know, with the relaunch of Middle Theory, and by the way, there is a new episode out of Middle Theory where we've gone into reports of missing persons cases, some which you may not have heard of before. And I'll tell you, this is a much broader phenomenon than most of us probably realize. I know David Pilates has written a lot about this and how it happens in the national parks, but I mean, there are cases that just blow my mind, and some of them are so unsettling. We devote about an hour to that on this new edition of Middle Theory, but I've noticed that apparently we've got tech support working on this for us right now. The RSS feed is still misbehaving, and that was why there was a delay in the new episode being posted at the website, and now apparently it's online via iTunes and Stitcher, but the latest episode, there's an all-new episode, and that's not available through the podcatching clients. You can go to middletheory.com, and you can access that via the player right there on the website, but we're working on getting that back out via the RSS feeds to everybody. Oh gosh, I tell you, it has been an extremely eventful last couple of days for me. I have been, as some of you know, in fact, I actually ran into a couple of listeners out there in Colorado. I was actually summoned to Colorado by none other than Coast to Coast host George Norrie for his Gaiam television series Beyond Belief. We taped two episodes. And while I was there, I met Susan Massino, who I've got to get on the program sometime fairly soon. If you're not familiar with her, she's really something else. Susan is a rock and roll journalist, and she it goes back to 77 or 1978. She met AC/DC and has written a couple of books that deal with them, as well as other subjects. But in addition to her incredible background with rock and roll, and actually not just rock and roll, but really the roots of rock and roll too, she wrote a book about the lives of all three of the men in the family of men whose names are Hank Williams. We have Hank Williams Sr., Hank Williams Jr., and Hank Williams III. Of course, Hank Sr., Hiram, I believe, Hiram, however you pronounce that. I think he passed away only at age 29, but really talk about a guy who had a legacy with his songwriting. And then, of course, Bo Cephas, still around, doesn't grant very many interviews. He's featured in the book, but really Hank III, the guy who spent all the time with Susan as she wrote this book. This guy lent a lot of information to this. I can think maybe of no figure in country music history that's quite as ghostly as Hank Williams. And interestingly, she said that part of the interviews for the book conducted with Hank Williams III, whose real name is actually Shelton, and I've had very brief, fleeting, but nonetheless correspondences with him in the past, he apparently, at the time that the interviews were being done, lived in a haunted house outside of Nashville, an old abandoned kind of farmhouse, ranch house. And so you can only imagine what it would be like sitting there. And if you've ever looked at him, if you've ever looked at Shelton, a.k.a. Hank Williams III, he looks so much like his grandfather. And the similarity is just, it's almost uncanny. And she described to me, we were being picked up there at the, by the way, there's Red Pill Junkie in the chat room. Hi, RPJ. But as we were picked up there at the Denver airport, which is a whole nother subject, and I'm going to discuss that here in a minute. I'd mentioned previously that I would, and yeah, we will. But as we were picked up there at the airport by our driver, We were on our way from Denver, Colorado, out to Boulder, where we stayed for the weekend, where the Guyam television production facility is. Beautiful out there, by the way. Weather was gorgeous. Actually cooler here in Asheville upon getting back. And I'm hearing all these incredible stories from Susan on the way, and she says, just imagine sitting in an old abandoned, no, it wasn't abandoned, but it was an old, slightly run down, vintage, you know, very classy, but just it's an older house, this old ranch house. No question about it, they said. This place, everyone who had lived there said it was haunted. Some of Hank's band members said that they wouldn't even stay there. You know, they said that this place was clearly haunted, and that many people who had stayed there, and Hank himself had told stories about this place. And she's sitting there interviewing him, and behind him up on the wall is this painting of his grandfather that looks just like him. It's almost like the picture of Dorian Gray or something, or Dark Shadows, you know, where you've got this supposed ancient ancestor, but he looks like he's sitting right there in front of you in a haunted ranch house outside of Nashville. Really eerie stuff. So we'll have to get Susan on the program to talk about that, because not only does she discuss all this incredible stuff in relation to rock and roll with her writing and her career as a journalist, but she also has quite an interesting story with regard to her son and his purported memories of past lives. One in particular, in fact, that many have interpreted as being a life lived on a very famous large boat that sank. Use your imagination. So we'll have to get Susan on the program at some point. Wonderful person. We really hit it off, and it was a great time out there in Boulder, Colorado. Highly synchronistic, though. And I want to talk a minute about synchronicities before we get into the the devilry going out there in Denver. It was such a synchronistic experience, this particular trip. From the moment I left Asheville, I got on the plane and sat down next to a very lovely English woman. And the minute I sat down next to her, she says, "You seem so familiar. Are you on television?" And I said, "Well, I'm actually going out to film on television this weekend." We began talking, and she, too, was very interested in everything from past lives to iconography, beautiful artist. She had been here in North Carolina attending a lecture, or actually a series of lectures, probably something more of a small conference on iconography, which is image representations of the saints. And so we had a very spiritual discussion, and I walked her toward the baggage claim on my way to the A gate in Detroit. And then boarded my next plane, which at the time I did not know, but Susan Messina was actually on the plane with me. And then we arrived, of course, in Denver. And as I'm walking out to the exit labeled number 511 at the Denver International Airport, which was almost as big as everybody told me it was, I see my first two representations of artwork, one of them looking like some sort of a weird mixture of like a doomsday prophecy and like an episode of The Toxic Avenger. I don't know. This character is depicted, and he has this face mask on, but he's obviously meant to look very devilish, and he's wielding a sword. I have to say there's an awful lot of strange artwork, but nothing so strange as what I saw. I didn't actually catch this on my way out of the airport. Rob, our driver, was taking Susan and I in our car, and we were headed over to Boulder. It was on the way back after we'd finished filming. We were there Saturday and Sunday, and then Monday morning, Rob's taking me back, and we're talking, and we come up on the airport, and it was so ominous because it had been beautiful when we left Boulder, and the way that the sun breaking through the clouds was hitting the Rocky Mountains, it was just absolutely gorgeous. And then this rain starts to kind of drift in, and as the rain begins to roll in, the rain and the clouds, we're starting to get a little smattering, you know, of raindrops on the windshield. Off in the distance, I behold a pale horse. No, I'm serious. Although, actually, it wasn't all that pale. It was more kind of an off-blue color. It was huge, this giant horse rearing up. Now, if you've ever been out there, and if you've ever driven up to the Denver airport, you would probably already know what I'm talking about. And as we get up alongside this statue, it's this huge, you know, blue and kind of purplish horse rearing up on its hind legs with red eyes. Red reflective eyes. And I'm looking at this thing saying, what in the hell is that supposed to be representative of? Here we're about to get on a plane, you know, and it looks like one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, minus the man, is rearing up, raising hell over here, literally. And there's this huge storm flooding in behind this great big horse, and I'm thinking, what is this all about? It was indeed strange. I see Justin in the chat room says, if I had a free hand to design a public mural, I would produce something way more weird and sinister. Well, somebody still succeeded, I think, in producing something fairly sinister out there at the Denver airport, which apparently is what has kind of led to these conspiracies, and we mentioned this just, I think it was a couple of weeks ago here on the program, and I'd gone down a list of conspiracies as we were discussing D.B. Cooper, and I mentioned, or actually, I guess this is the Micah Hanks radio program. Damn, so many programs, it's hard to keep up with which one's which, right? But anyway, we've been going down the list of these conspiracies, and one, of course, specifically in relation to D.B. Cooper, a famous conspiracy, and I'm very interested in this. Because, of course, this was, I think, if I remember correctly, D.B. Cooper was the only instance of unexplained hijacking of an aircraft in recent history in America. I mean, I guess really in all history in America that I know of. And, of course, D.B. Cooper, we don't know exactly who that was. That was the name given, apparently, at the time that he attempted to hijack the plane, demanding a ransom. And, of course, his death-defying escape where he attempted to parachute out of the plane with the money. Some of the money was found. Cooper, as we remember him, was never discovered. We were discussing some of these. And there on this list of top 10 conspiracies was the Denver International Airport. I'm like, what in the world is that all about? And it said that many people have said that the art at the Denver International Airport evokes a lot of curiosity for the sometimes apocalyptic undertones. And there certainly was a lot of that. Now, as some people are saying in the chat room there, that's not every mural or other piece of artwork there at the Denver airport. But I'll tell you, that great big blue horse with red eyes rearing up with that storm coming in behind it wasn't exactly the most settling thing that you could imagine seeing as you're approaching an airport. I'm thinking of all the places that you would want to instill comfort in the minds of people who are about to board a plane and fly to God knows where. Oh, the mind reels, doesn't it? Very interesting stuff. And so I did manage to get a few pictures. Hopefully we'll be able to put something together with that, maybe write something about that, because I think it's a very interesting discussion, as the discussion which we're about to continue on the other side of this break will no doubt be for you, because there have been a lot of sightings of UFOs, particularly over parts of the UK the last couple of weeks. But what's really going on, and is there a lead now in what has been reported in the skies of Portsmouth? Also, something that's really been irking me for a while, Neil deGrasse Tyson, often rather derisive toward the subject of UFOs. Has he been caught telling a little fib? We'll look at that all when we come back on the Graylian Report. Yeah, seriously, if anybody out there knows what's really going on at the Denver International Airport, I'd love to hear from you. info@graylianreport.com. It's a story too good to miss. Speaking of stories too good to miss, before we get to a little bit of new UFO news, I do want to get to a few listener emails. We've had an awful lot of them. I haven't had enough time to respond to all of them, as I've been traveling a lot lately and working like the madman you know me to be. But that said, Michael writes, "G'day, Micah. My name's Michael. I'm a longtime listener and fan from rural Australia, and I have an interesting story to share about a recurring dream, or rather a nightmare I often had as a child." Now, you guys remember, I put this out to you a while back. The question was, if you have recurring dreams, I'd like to hear from you. I'd like to hear what kind of recurring dreams you may have experienced in your lifetime. And so I put out questions to the listenership from time to time. I love to see what kinds of responses we get about these kinds of things. Now, Michael writes, "I'm 19 years old now, but I still remember in vivid detail the terror that I felt in these dreams. I must have been between the ages of 6 and 10 at the time. In the dream, which was extremely lucid and felt very real, the Hamburglar, as in the character from the McDonald's fast food chain, would break into my room through the window and start breaking my favorite toys and basically making a mess out of my room. He would mock me and laugh maniacally as I begged him to stop and called for my parents, who would never come. Now, this dream carried on consistently for years, and it's never lost its, well, its realness, or lucidity, perhaps, is a better word. Every night I would wake up with my room in perfect order and be thankful that it was only a dream. However, it led to me developing, get this, an actual fear. No, a palpable hatred of that character. And I remember I had a picture of him I'd cut out of a McHappy Meal box on a dartboard in my room when I was 9 years old. And my parents thought it was very strange, but also found it entertaining. They still bring up how, quote, our son Michael hated the Hamburglar as a kid because he was constantly terrorized by him in dreams. Now, to this day, when I see the character in advertisements and whatnot, I feel a sense of foreboding and fear. He never stole any hamburgers from me. He was just after the destruction of my most precious childhood material possessions. It was like he fed off of my misery and my fear. I laugh about it now, and whenever the topic of dreams comes up around friends, I tell them of this dream every time, and we always laugh about it. But when I was a child, I think the dream really had an effect on my real life, even if it was just in the development of a fear of the Hamburglar. So yeah, thanks a ton, and keep up the good work, Michael. You know, I sometimes wonder, do you remember at the end of Ghostbusters how when Zool appears and everybody's trying to keep their minds free and open, and then all of a sudden in the distance the quaking of giant footsteps can be heard or felt if you'd been standing on top of that building next to Bill Murray and everybody, and the Ghostbuster Ray, as portrayed by Dan Aykroyd, is the one that admits that he couldn't help it. He tried to think of the most harmless thing that he could from his childhood, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. Sometimes I think that in our own mind or in our own lives, the strangest and seemingly most harmless things can take on a negative kind of representation. That would be an interesting question in a continuation of this spiraling, spinning, storytelling web that we've been weaving with the reports from the listeners that have to do with these kinds of encounters in dreams, these recurring dreams. I would like to ask, in the tradition of things like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, or maybe like of Pennywise, as we remember from the film and the book rendition by Stephen King, It, where a clown becomes something. Again, clowns are actually pretty scary, but the idea here was that something that would be identifiable to children as being amusing becomes horrifying. I think thanks to old Pennywise, that's probably the very reason, if not John Wayne Gacy, that most of us find clowns pretty creepy. Which has its own kind of ties to Fortiana unto itself, but I digress. But if you're somebody who recalls from your childhood being terrified of something that everybody else thought was okay, the Easter Bunny. Remember that scene in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey? Theodore, you made your little brother cry! You probably know what I'm talking about. If you've had something like that happen, and something that shouldn't have been scary just became horrible to you, maybe it'll help to get it off your chest. So email me, info@micahanks.com or info@graylianreport.com. They both come to the same place. I'd just like for you to have options. G also writes, you know, I've watched what I believe to be UAV training around 1999 and 2000 just east of Groom Lake. This was around the time of the first generation Predators being fielded by Indian Springs, which came from Creech Air Force Base. It was too dark to tell if they were drones, but they flew very slowly. Well, he goes on to say basically that the aircraft appeared north of Bald Mountain, which is north of the box around Groom Lake. And apparently they flew southward after that, just east of the box over Tikaboo Valley, and then turned east near Tikaboo Peak, flew eastward a hit, and then started to fly north. And at that point, they were now on either side of the people with me. The only odd thing seen was one of the aircraft flashed a strobed beam upward, which lit up the clouds. But perhaps there was a high flyer orbiting over the airspace, and this was a signal. Apparently, as G writes, this gave the appearance, however, these aircraft flying in formation like this, of a miles-long aircraft at times. You know, when I was filming with Beyond Belief this weekend, George Norrie asked me at one point, he said, William Cooper, what do you think about that guy? And I thought that's a really interesting question to bring up in relation to UFO discussion, because Bill Cooper was somebody who spent a lot of time. He'd go out there and he even filmed things over Area 51. Now, look, I want to be very clear, because I've devoted entire programs to the discussion of William Cooper in the past. I find him to be a very fascinating person. And this is what I actually said to George Norrie during the taping this weekend. He's a fascinating person. Some of the perspectives he lends on UFOs were not only fascinating, I think that they were really, really, really close to home in terms of what is actually probably happening a majority of the time in our skies. He also independently came to the determination that he felt his government had lied to him, and he no longer believed after a certain point the extraterrestrial hypothesis of UFOs. He thought that these were government craft that were being produced. And he had even filmed strange things out there near Area 51. His life ended tragically, but we must remember also that there was a police officer killed, and it was a shootout that probably never should have happened and probably could have also been avoided. I think that there are a lot of questions, but a lot of people also forget that really Coop had some issues in his life. You know, I guess there's good with the bad, but remembering it in totality, I still find some of the things that William Cooper wrote to be very interesting, and that kind of reminds me of those kinds of things. Interesting, some of the stuff we do see in the skies from time to time. Sean writes, you know, first off, I have to say I really love your program and really find you to be an interesting and well-spoken and well-read presenter and radio personality. Thank you for that. I've been listening to Paranormal Esoteric podcasts every night while falling asleep for the past 3 years, and so far my favorite shows are a tie between Grayling Report and Mysterious Universe, good buddies of ours down in Australia. I was just curious, as you always talk about such interesting topics and new books in various fields of study, and so he wanted to know, what are some good introductory texts in this field? And he names a few subjects he's interested in, but I thought that it would be good to read this on the air here, at least a portion of that email from Sean in New Jersey, because I get a lot of emails from people wanting to know what good books to read. You know, what are the best books in this field? If I like this stuff, if I'm interested in this, you know, how can I learn more about it? And basically, I would break this down. The three categories he mentions here are UFOs, abductions, and cryptids. If I had to, right off the bat, recommend a good book about cryptids, I have to say this. There are still good books that are written about these subjects, but it seems that decades ago, in my opinion, the best books were written. Last week, we were talking with Karen Dolan, and she had mentioned, I think, at one point that she apologized and said, I really don't follow a lot of the more modern researchers. I don't watch a lot of television, and so I may not be as up to speed. And I'm thinking, hell, you know, you mentioned Ivan Sanderson. I would rather talk about Ivan Sanderson and people like that. And when it comes to books about cryptozoology, his book, Abominable Snowmen: Legend Come to Life, is one of the best books. One of the most comprehensive international surveys of purported wild men reports that has ever been offered. Second to that book, I would recommend John Napier's book from 1972 titled Bigfoot, in which he gives, again, a very skeptical analysis of abominable snowmen claims, as well as the what were at the time called abominable snowmen of the Americas, i.e. Bigfoot. Some very interesting interpretations there. I think that also Lauren Coleman's Bigfoot, The True Story of Apes in America is good, but those are just Bigfoot books. And there's a lot of stuff going on in cryptozoology. You might enjoy the writings of Carl Shuker, who we've had on the program as well. He wrote a book that Anomalous Books published called Mirabilis, which it doesn't talk about sea monsters. It doesn't talk about Bigfoot and ape men, all the conventional cryptids. Carl Shuker's work really looks more at reports of animals as yet unidentified by science and unknown to exist officially, but nonetheless for which reports, anecdotal and otherwise, over the years have continued to be forthcoming. So Mirabilis is an interesting book just as well. Carl Shuker's work is quite reputable and very interesting just as well. In the UFO field, there are almost too many to name, and I'm very excited to say that Patrick Weege contacted me while I was in Denver. And actually, I was in Boulder, but he mentioned to me that Anomalous Books is reprinting, at his request, one of Jacques Vallée's books, a famous book called The Invisible College. And so I'm very eager to take a look at that after all these years. Jacques Vallée's books, of course, are probably the penultimate, in my opinion, authorities on the UFO phenomenon. And, of course, Dimensions, Confrontations, and Revelations, those three books certainly should be read by anyone. But to get a good overview of the UFO phenomena, I think also Edward Ruppelt's book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, it's important to read because he's the guy that coined the term. So many other books also that I could mention. I think Leslie Kane's book on UFOs was really good, as was John Alexander's, and Richard Dolan's trilogy at present on UFOs and the national security state would probably rank high up there just as well. If you've got other books that you would like to recommend, I'd like to hear those from you, you know, because I'm usually the one who's giving book recommendations, and these days I hardly have a lot of time to read. I wish I had more. But if you got books that you think really must be read, send ideas along. But although I have to be honest with you, I don't spend that much time reading Fortean themed subjects, you know, or about them. I spend more time reading about science, particularly astronomy, physics, and chemistry, and a good bit of history as well. And, you know, those kinds of things. That's what really what I read an awful lot about. Subscribe to a lot of the government secrecy and political newsletters and things. So it's funny for somebody who does a program like this, and I'm reading all this other stuff. A lot of it we get into, by the way, on the Middle Theory podcast. So again, check out middletheory.com for more on that. Lots of good books out there, though. Lots of good books. Cal writes, I've been working on a new theory, and I call it time echoes. I think that ghosts, UFOs, aliens, gods, and visions from the Bible are all the same thing and can be seen in these time echoes. Some people have crossed over into another time echo, but you don't have to travel in time to see the future or the past. Thanks, Cal. Good idea. As a matter of fact, I think that, again, I look at ghosts as being evidence of some sort of a phenomena that is in keeping with the same entropic forces that govern the way the mind works. Stephen Hawking has often said in the past that he believes that the human mind remembers and memories are representative of past events because our minds function in the same way that, or direction, as he calls it, a thermodynamic arrow of time in which entropy increases, and hence we don't remember the future. But really, the idea of past, present, and future all exist in one place. It's just not perceptible as such, according to humans. But this might explain, if this is indeed the case, if there are temporary breakdowns in our knowledge, or I should say rather our understanding presently of space-time and physics, this could explain everything from ghostly phenomenon to premonitions of the future. And I can't help but wonder if we are able to perceive things that we would call a ghost from the past, what happens if it goes the other way? Or does it? Or could it? If a person could have a premonition, we might posit that we might also be able to perceive aspects of the future, such as what we might call a ghost from the future, which, if I remember correctly, was the original working title of a book that later became, as told to me by the author, Chariots of the Gods. That's right, Mr. Von Daniken told me in 2012 that was originally what I was going to call my book, Ghosts of the Future. Interesting stuff, huh? Finally, I think, we've got a couple more emails here, actually, and I promised I'd like to get to a few of them. Matthew writes, Mike, and my name's Matthew, and last night a buddy of mine and I were fishing on Assateague Island, part of the National Seashore, just south of Ocean City, Maryland. Now, that it may be Assateague. I'm not sure. Somebody may want to correct my pronunciation there. He says, we both saw these weird orange lights all of a sudden in the southeastern sky. So again, this is going to be just off the coast of Ocean City, Maryland. I'd like to hear if anyone else has seen these. He said they seemed to appear, then disappear, then appear again really slowly. They looked almost rectangular, at least to me, not like a shooting star or anything I'd ever seen. He said we were looking online for something similar, and then we found your blog. So we were wondering if anyone ever confirmed one way or another what these things might be. I do know, Matthew, these things are seen an awful lot out there near, really all parts of South Carolina, but from anywhere from Somerville to Charleston, South Carolina, down there along the coast, there are a lot of reports of things. Even Greenville, we've talked about a few sightings of these orange orbs around Greenville just as well. Florida, they've been seen off the coast of Florida. Really all kinds of places. Who knows? Everyone typically says Chinese lanterns, but yet again, the majority of the UFO reports I get, we talked about some pretty incredible airship sightings last week, but the majority of the reports that I get these days are described more like that, you know, orange lights that all of a sudden appear and then disappear. That seems a lot more ambiguous than the kind of UFOs that were being reported in the 50s and 60s. Why the change? Something I've continually wanted to know. Farusha writes, Micah, I was at the Cherry Hill MUFON event, and kindly I was allowed to show some of my artwork there. It was pretty well organized, but what was missing were reports of UFO sightings from recent years. Well, how about that? She says, I'm a multiple experiencer. The phenomena is real. And it seems to me we are akin to a South Seas cargo cult. We do not have the intelligence to perceive what is truly happening. Humans are not atop the intergalactic multidimensional food chain. And another thing, she says, as a woman, it is more difficult to be taken seriously in ufology. That's a shame. All very good points, though, actually. Thank you for writing that, Farusha. I think this is our final letter here. Actually, yeah, this will have to be, really, because I want to move on. Doris had written, and she'd said that on the August 27th edition of the program, she'd heard Father Jack Ashcraft mention David Spangler, in which she was wondering if he was one of the ones involved in the New Age Nazi cult or if he was someone who was aware of them. Now, I don't know exactly what Father Jack's interpretation of that would be. Spangler, of course, had been a self-described practical mystic. He had actually, I think, been someone who was instrumental in what was called the Findhorn Foundation. There was a book that was written a number of decades ago called The Magic of Findhorn. And he apparently, the story's pretty interesting. He'd gone to Britain, and he had visited the little community there of Findhorn. This is located in northern Scotland, where they're all arguing about this referendum. And I've been getting emails about that, too, but we'll save that for the Middle Theory program this week, because there's some interesting stuff about that, I think, too. But anyway, Spangler claimed he had that he had received sort of a download from the Mother Throne, some sort of a message from a non-physical entity of some sort. And they had told him that he should go to Europe where he would find the next cycle of his work. Well, he arrived at Findhorn, and the story goes that he met a woman there named Eileen Caddy, and she told him that she had had a vision 3 years before that, that a man, and this was reportedly very specific to her, she said that I was told I would meet a man named David Spangler. He would be coming here to live and work in our community. And she and her husband, Peter, and another colleague of theirs named Dorothy McLean, apparently said that they had been waiting ever since that time for someone with the name of David Spangler to arrive. Well, when he arrived with that name, having purportedly seeking some sort of a connection in Europe, he was offered a job of joint directorship of the community of Findhorn, along with Peter Caddy. And so he accepted it, and he stayed there until 1973 before coming back to the United States. And apparently, he and a number of associates, after doing so, founded what was called the Lorien Association, which was a nonprofit aimed at trying to educate people about spirituality. Really interesting stuff. And I'd like to, again, if there were any way that that could have been independently verified, that Mrs. Caddy would have had a vision that a David Spangler was going to show up. 3 years later, David Spangler goes to Europe looking for some sort of a spiritual calling and finds it at, of all places, Findhorn. Boy, how weird would that be? That seems to be the problem with a lot of these claims, is that it's a little difficult to independently verify them. But if there's any way that that could be done, that would seem to be an extremely, maybe an excruciatingly synchronistic experience. And speaking of synchronistic experiences, there are so many more that I don't have time to get to. I'm sure that later this week on the subscriber podcast, Greyland X, I want to devote a little time to synchronicities and some really far out ones that occurred out there with yours truly while I was in Denver. Some of these things, I'm going to have to save it for Greyland X, not to completely tease about that. I've discussed, I think, a lot of the big things that happened while I was out there, but some of it's really, I think I would like to confide to the private ears of our subscribers on some of that. But synchronicity's certainly been on my mind a lot lately. And it seems to be something that just kind of tends to crop up a lot when you study this sort of stuff. Another reason why this year, this month's episode of Enigmas actually features Wings Over West Virginia, some of John Keel's work. He was involved in a lot more than just Mothman. And so I can guarantee you'll hear all of that on Enigmas. Changing gears here just for a moment. There have been a lot of reports of something seen over, I think Portsmouth is actually the area in the UK. There's a photograph that appeared online. Purportedly, a lot of people have been tweeting about it. It was described as a silvery gray disc-like shape pictured hovering over houses in a photograph. Now, from the outset, I think that there had been people saying it could be a hoax. The photograph, I have to say, though, isn't really all that impressive. And I think sometimes birds and things can show up and give a rather misleading appearance when someone takes a picture. I'm always a little suspect if somebody says, I took the picture, I never saw the thing, I developed the picture, and I looked at it later, and there was this object. Well, this looked like one of those until, well, more recently, when three young men, apparently identified as Daniel Cook, Matthew Harrison, and Joshua Hibbard, who are shown here emerging from a TARDIS with a hoverboard, Back to the Future style, are pictured. They claim to have actually been the creators of this UFO hoax, which, again, the photo wasn't all that impressive, but I don't think that they expected this to go quite as viral as it did in this era in which basically anything, photo or video, can apparently go viral. Apparently, they were doing this as a publicity stunt to draw attention to an upcoming science fiction and fantasy festival. The event organizer Joshua Hibbard of North End said, "We got 8 to 10 people from around Portsmouth to take a picture at the same time on the same evening." He said, "I emailed them to another organizer, Dan Cook, who is a whiz with Photoshop." He added the UFO and we had help from others to get people talking about it on social media. He said it's amazing how people's imagination have been taken by this. We really didn't expect it to get as big as it has. Well, maybe it got even bigger than he realized, because you know, yet again, over Portsmouth, the Metro in the UK was reporting on something extremely strange that was photographed by Florence Lehman. Apparently 7:20 in the morning yesterday morning, who spotted an unusually shaped contrail over her home around the South Sea area. Now, the teacher had said, it's really weird. It looks like the pilot sneezed or fell asleep. What we're talking about here is a contrail that literally forms a huge curving S in the sky. I mean, literally, it wouldn't be that hard to believe that somebody might have fallen asleep, lost control, or maybe had been taking some sort of evasive action to try and dodge something up there in the sky. The photos are online. We've got them linked at Grayley and Report Daily News right now. You'll just visit over at the site, www.grayleyandreport.com. If you happen to be listening on September 23rd for the live show, you'll be able to see them right there, but you can always access the archives. If you go down to the little drop-down and select in the category drop-down, news, you can see all the past news, and there's more links to 4TN articles from around the world on a daily basis than you could probably fathom. And we provide those every day for free right there at grayleyandreport.com. The final thing I wanted to talk about this hour before we get into some Hollow Earth mysteries is Neil deGrasse Tyson. You know, I think really, first of all, I'll say this, that the relaunch of Cosmos was really well done. I think that following someone I admire as much as Carl Sagan, Neil deGrasse Tyson's a great guy to follow in his footsteps. I think that there were a few things that Carl Sagan had said and done, you know, in his days, especially as it relates to the potential for there being unexplained phenomena that he may have been more than willing to overlook, that irked me a bit. I think that's far more the case with Neil deGrasse Tyson. And frankly, I find that Neil deGrasse Tyson at times seems to be ever so slightly duplicitous. I think that there's a side of him that seems to be very open and very willing to be open-minded. There are times he said things about UFOs that I fully agree with, and then there are times where I see him getting up in front of like a PSYCOP event, or rather a James Randi Foundation event specifically, is the video I'm thinking of. On Grayley and X podcast, we actually devoted a little time to this one time, did a breakdown of Neil deGrasse Tyson, basically doing what, I mean, I kind of called it like a stand-up routine. It's not a lecture. He's up there, he's working the crowd, he's running back and forth, he's laughing, he's telling jokes, and just backhand slapping ufology. And I'm thinking, you know, are you a scientist, or are you just trying to be a personality? You know, and you've got to be careful when you're an educator like that, how you present words. It is very important, I think, that you remember when you are any kind of a public persona, but especially if you are an educator, how you present yourself and the words you use. Now, Neil deGrasse Tyson has fallen under a good bit of criticism recently, especially over at the website thefederalist.com. And there's a guy, Sean Davis, who's been carrying a couple of articles that have been going after Tyson for some things he's been saying. Now, here's basically the situation. According to Tyson, in the days following the 9/11 terrorist attacks, he has repeatedly quoted President George W. Bush is saying, "Our God is the God who named the stars." Now, according to Tyson, the president made that claim as a way of segregating radical Islam from religions like Christianity or Judaism. And then there's a video linked in this article at The Federalist, which I recognize actually as being, very interestingly, the same discussion where I had talked about Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, slapping ufology around on stage. It's more of a stand-up routine than anything. I can see by the color of the stage, the MacBook on the little podium next to him, and the clothing he's wearing. There's a very distinctive-looking vest that he's wearing. This is obviously the same video. And if I remember correctly, I think that was actually speaking before James Randi Foundation group of skeptics. And he's quoted here saying, here's what happens. George Bush, within a week of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, gave us a speech attempting to distinguish we from they. And who are they? These were sort of the Muslim fundamentalists, and he wants to distinguish we from they. And how does he do it? He says, our God, of course it's actually the same God, but that's a detail. Let's hold the minor fact aside for the moment. Allah of the Muslims is the same God as the God of the Old Testament, but let's hold that aside. He says, our God is the God, he loosely quotes Genesis, biblical Genesis, our God is the God who named the stars. Okay, so that's the quote from Neil deGrasse Tyson. So Sean Davis goes after it and says, Neil deGrasse Tyson's story has three central claims: that Bush uttered that precise phrase, that it happened right after 9/11, and he said it in order to distance American religion from that practiced by radical Muslims. Well, he says, first of all, Bush never uttered the quote attributed to him by Tyson. He did, however, include a separate but similar phrase in a February 2003 speech immediately following the Columbia space shuttle disaster, not in relation to 9/11. In fact, Sean says, I don't have a PhD in physics, but I'm pretty sure February 2003 did not happen in the week after 9/11. Tyson apparently butchered the quote, and he butchered the date, he butchered the context. He butchered the implication, but get this, this is interesting. Bush's statement about the Creator had nothing to do with making us look better than them, as Tyson has asserted. It was an attempt to comfort the families who had lost loved ones in that crash in relation to the Columbia incident. They weren't nameless creatures who passed away anonymously. Their ultimate Creator, the one who knit them together in their mother's wombs, mourned them by name. Well, anyway, it goes on down here, and it shows, and this is what's maybe most interesting to me. It says, after deliberately slandering President Bush by attributing to him a quote he never made, Tyson launched into another tirade about how he was selected by Bush to be on a committee to select recipients of the National Medals of Science and Technology. The point of that story? That Tyson is way smarter than Bush, who Tyson intimated was too stupid to even read the citations of the awards. But if you watch the video of the event, which they have linked in the article, you'll notice that the reason Bush didn't read the citations is because he was too busy personally awarding the medals and shaking the hands of the guests of honor, while an MC had actually been reading the citations. This is what's interesting, too, and I love this. Apparently, Tyson says Bush's unfortunate God quote came long before Tyson was in Bush's Rolodex and long before he was selected to serve on commissions to advise the president. But get this. Apparently, on August 22, 2001, the White House press office announced that the president would appoint one Neil deGrasse Tyson of New York to serve on the Commission on the Future of the United States Aerospace Industry. Yet again, August 22, 2001 was a few weeks before, not after September 11, 2001. Now, there was an apparent response from Tyson that appeared online in relation to this and other articles that had been written by Sean Davis over there at The Federalist, and he writes, "Thanks for your interest in my work. Just some background. When I'm invited to give a talk, especially to an audience that is not the general public, but to a specific gathering of people within a trade, I tune the contents for that audience, for that time, and for that place. So tone and flavor and context and intent are all key elements to any message I convey, all missing to anyone who was not present at the time." Yet again, I ask, as an educator, do you not have a certain obligation to spread a universal message of truth and to be honest? And if you can't be honest, at very least, try and treat the facts with greater care than that. I think that that is a bit of a problem when we have somebody like Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is an educator and possibly one of the most apparent public educators. And I think that when he is so loose with the facts, you know, it's not a political argument. It's not about George Bush. It's about the way that words being used by one of the most visible public educators in America today, in the world, in fact. You know, and when he says, I'm sorry, I tailor the tone and flavor and the context to the people I'm talking to in any given case, seems a little bizarre. Okay, we'll take a turn for the Hollow Earth when we come back here on the Graylian Report.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Welcome back. Second hour of this week's edition of the program, and I'm glad to have you here with me as always. For those just tuning in, I'm Micah Hanks, the Mouth of the South, and this is the Graylian Report. Today, gosh, stop me if I've said it already, but here in the Southeast, there's just a little bit of a twinge of cool in the air. And, God, is that even a word, twinge? Anyway, but you know what I mean. There's just this little, well, fall's here. The leaves haven't quite started to change, but it's beautiful, and it's crisp outside. Brisk, even, in fact. And when this kind of weather arrives every year, you know, I think it gives us a little time to think about, well, we've made it through another summer, and the cold weather months lay ahead. Time to bunker down for some of us. Some of us live in arid, hot climates no matter what time of the year. All my friends out there in Southern California, you know what I'm talking about. You may be looking forward to the months that feel like spring for everyone else, but up here in the mountains, it has just continued to get cooler and cooler. And, you know, when I was out there in Denver this past weekend, one of the other guests that was filming with George Norrie for Beyond Belief was Robert Felix. And he's a guy who's written a book that kind of examines the climate change thing and whether or not we're actually heading into a period of global cooling rather than the kind of global warming that we all have been told is happening. And I'm not here to try and preach to you either for or against. I've made my position on that pretty clear before in the past already. But it's an interesting discussion, and Robert looks at things like the Maunder Minimum. I have to say, if you look at the Maunder Minimum, that period in history just a few hundred years ago where we actually went through a little ice age, this seemed to correspond with bizarre sunspot activity, the likes of which we've been seeing in recent years just as well. Our sun seems so out of whack, everything's weird. You know, and the 11-year cycle of predictability hasn't really been the cycle that's been adhered to. And so there are a lot of predictions about, well, when the sun does eventually wake up, what's going to happen? Are we going to have a Carrington-type event? Who knows? Last winter, I do know this, was very cold here in Asheville, North Carolina. It's looking like this one's going to be cold again. And there was a lot of discussion when Robert Felix was talking about the polar vortex that we saw over the Midwest last winter. You know, especially Minneapolis, Minnesota, where I'll be here in a few weeks. I remember in 2012, that first Paradigm Symposium, you know, it was so pleasant outside. The leaves had begun to change. It felt outside at night like it feels here in Asheville right now, every night. And we would go out, and I was making phone calls. I went on my buddy Dobie Maxwell's radio show, The Mothership. Haven't heard from Dobie in a while. But it was an exciting time. And to me, that crispness in the air kind of accentuates that, among other things, as we'll discuss here in a moment. But, you know, another thing that really sticks out to me is the fact that, I mean, it was still warm in the daytime. And then last year it was a little cooler. Hell, it snowed last year at Paradigm Symposium. We were across the river in St. Paul. And a few weeks ago, I called Scotty Roberts to check in, and he had said, yeah, we already have unseasonably cool weather up here in Minneapolis right now. Well, he's actually in southern Wisconsin. But if you're in the Twin Cities area, before I get up there, why don't you send me an email, info@graylianreport.com. Let me know what the weather's like up there in the Twin Cities so I'll know what to pack in my bags when I go. You know, I usually carry a lot of things, you know, scarves, gloves, and things typically if I'm going to be headed up north in the fall. Or the spring, for that matter, because you just don't know anymore. So I guess we'll see. But down here in the South, as the changes of the season begin to occur, you know, it's a beautiful time of the year, and I love it, and it's exciting. But there's also, I don't know, you know, there's this little kind of a, I don't know, there's a wispy kind of a sense of, well, change to come. It happens every year. I hear it every single year. And I enjoy that. I welcome it. But it's at times even slightly bittersweet, you know? It's funny how there are things in life that can be both exciting and bittersweet all at once. But I don't know if it's the symbolism of, as the leaves fall, the symbolism of death, which is maybe the very same that we associate with around the time of Halloween, you know? The death and the rebirth, out with the old and in with the new, transitions, change, all these kinds of things. Now, somebody had sent me an email. It may have been Mark Brady. Boy, we hear his name on here a lot, but of course, Mark provides an awful lot in terms of news to us on a weekly basis. Thank you for that, Mark, by the way, who I just emailed before we took the airwaves earlier tonight. And this link is to a study titled Embers of Society, Firelight Talk Among the Yuhasan Bushmen. And the idea here is that the control of fire and the capacity for cooking over an open flame essentially led to major anatomical and residential changes for early humans. And this started more than a million years ago, of course, but little known is about really what inspired, or rather I should say transpired, when the day was extended by firelight. There was a documentary that was made about this a while back, about how essentially we have light at all times if we need it. And I've found that if I'm watching television, I don't own a TV, but I watch Netflix, and so if I've got a computer, you know, bombarding my eyes with UV light before I go to bed, I won't sleep as well. You know, there's a point beyond which in the evenings I usually have to turn the computer off. And I'm kind of old-fashioned. I'm a fan of reading a book before I go to sleep. And nothing will put me to sleep more quickly. Nothing will make me more drowsy than reading a book. But when we're talking about the way that firelight extending light into evening and essentially enhancing our ability to carry out daytime tasks, the point after which this actually happened isn't as well recognized. And maybe the cultural changes that originate from that are also interesting and worthy of question. Now, of course, they're obviously very interesting to me, but the reason why is more specifically not how light all night changes our lives, especially in cities that, well, as the old saying goes, never sleep like New York. No, more specifically, what I'm talking about is, you know, the idea of firelight. Think about that. There is the archetypal experience that occurs around campfires, and what is that? That is the experience of storytelling, right? Well, weenie roasts, some of you are probably thinking, marshmallow roasts, okay, whatever. No. When we are gathered around a campfire, the experience of storytelling is something I remember from my youth, and I think concomitant with our study of, well, the changes, physiological and otherwise, that ancient humans underwent as they were building fires and extending the light from daylight into the dark, and thus enhancing and even, you know, prolonging their daytime activities to some extent, was this also? You know, I mean, think about this. In ancient times, I think we kind of evolved to fear the night to an extent. Why? Well, because we couldn't see, and we also knew that there were predators who had evolved to hunt by night. They have, you know, much greater night vision capability than humans do, especially in perfect darkness, in the absence of a new moon or a full moon. And so when we hear about ancient people and how they adapted to change in the environment, even with the inclusion of a fire or a torch, I still think that there was a natural fear of the dark. And yet huddled by the fire, there was a protection. We can stay awake, we can carry out certain daylight tasks, but we still move more carefully because there are things out there in the dark which hunt us, which would kill us, which would take our life. And we retell the stories of those kinds of encounters when we gather by the firelight that protects us from darkness. So who knows? We could postulate all evening about what exactly the exchange was, what exactly the transition was, and what exactly culminated in the telling of tales around campfire light. But right here at this time of the year in the fall, in the autumn months, as we enter the cool weather, as we enter the night of the year, so to speak, you know, we've had the sunshine of summer, and now we kind of enter the cool darkness of winter. The days are shorter, and in some parts of the world, there are no days. Remember 30 days of night? How fitting to pair vampires with that. Because, again, our fascination with the night seems to lead to our legends of the strange and the darkness. And I remember as a child loving sitting around the campfire and hearing ghost stories and strange stories. And so as a little bit of a primer, as we're entering the fall month, there are going to be other subjects that we'll be discussing in the next few weeks, especially as we enter October. And even after the Paradigm Symposium and the Madness, which is going to be the first weekend of October this year, so there'll be a whole month of oddities and strangeness and curiosities, but more importantly, those that kind of deal with the macabre that we'll be examining as we get close to Halloween. But I remember some of my favorite stories, campfire stories, and those deal with things that come from below ground. Now, I don't know why that has always been something that is truly disturbing to me, the idea of things that might exist in caves beneath the earth. One of the producers, Frank, that had been working on the program with us this weekend, filming with George Norrie, he caught me after George and I had filmed our episodes, and as I come out, he stops me and he says, you know, I can see you're a little more of a skeptic. And I said, well, yeah, but I certainly think that there's a phenomena. And he said, you know, I'm actually friends with Joseph Farrell. And we got to talking, and he seemed to be a very like mind, but this guy was so interested in these ideas of there being things going on underground. And at one point, as we're talking, Tom Danheiser, producer of Coast to Coast, steps over and he says, man, isn't that incredible, these stories about the underground oceans and things, which actually literally exist within, you know, areas of the inner earth, the likes of which we discuss on this program from time to time, albeit anecdotally or sometimes even in pure jest. Of course, I'm referring to the Mohorovicic discontinuity. But it is known that there are chasms, you know, and that there are cavernous systems, many of them aqueous, but nonetheless represented deep, deep, deep within the earth. And modern seismology helps us determine that this is indeed the reality of our underground. But this theory lends itself, despite the fact that there is probably more liquid underground than there are empty cavernous cave systems that are potentially inhabited. And when we talk about extremophiles, you know, different kinds of biological organisms that may exist and that they time and time again have proven to exist in these strangest places, you know, places, for instance, lava vents deep within the ocean. You know, all kinds of locations that would be the last place you'd ever expect for life to occur. I can't help but entertain the idea that even in aqueous subsystems deep beneath the earth, that there might be strange varieties of life, extremophiles of a totally different variety, that might do what we've already been proven time and time again can do, which is exist varieties of life in the absence of sunlight, and perhaps deep, deep, deep within the earth, but even in the absence of water. I wonder if in some of the cavernous systems that exist throughout all parts of the United States, and although we know about a lot of them, we've charted a lot of them, especially cave systems beneath Kentucky and things like that, we know an awful lot of what is out there, but there is still so much more, I would argue, that still escapes us. And so when it comes to these campfire stories, I've always been fascinated by those ideas of things that might exist underground and the possibilities, the implications that may arise from that. Now just think for a moment, and we're going to get to a little bit of Halloween-esque storytelling here in a moment as we're getting near to fall, but first I want to set the stage for you. A lot of people have tried to speculate, how could a creature like Bigfoot, for example, how could a creature like Bigfoot really remain hidden? How could something so human, so much like us, evade capture, evade discovery? Where do they hide? You know, what do? They crawl back up into the brush on the high mountain passes in the daytime, and do they sleep, and then do they hunt by night like the ancient enemies of ancient man once did, the lions and the tigers and the oh my, the bears? You know, what is it about the way that the Sasquatch exist, if they exist, that keeps them so well hidden? But one theory that has been put forward, and laugh if you may, but this is one that has always intrigued me just as well. What if these things literally take to the underground? What if they take to cavernous areas below ground, and that is essentially how they are able to keep so well hidden? Could it be that this is a part of the reason that the persistent mystery of the Sasquatch, we hear reports of these things, they are seen from time to time, and yet they're so difficult to put a finger on. Maybe that's why. Maybe they are actually much more well traversed in terms of the underground realm than humans are. And I've talked about this numerous times on the program. You may remember, unless you're a new listener. We've got a lot of new listeners, of course. But we've talked on the program in the past about the book by Jeff Long. It's a fiction novel, but it's called The Descent. And there was a film that was based on it that was fairly good, but I don't think that the film did the book justice. That's usually the case with books, though. People who are avid readers know film renditions often take away, you know, to an extent, from the idea that was being expressed by the book. And the book is quite prolific, and there are actually sequels just as well, which I haven't read, but I really should make time to do one day. Ha! Make time. I'd have to have a TARDIS to do that. And in the book, Jeff Long, he begins the story in a cave in the Himalayas, or the Himalayas, as John Keel would say. And there's a group of weekend climbers and their guide and his wife who are trapped in this cave. They've been trapped by a snowstorm, and there's something, some sort of an illumination on one far end of the cave, and they go over and investigate. And they find that the illuminations are actually radioactive tattoos that are carved on a mummy that's hanging on the wall with the name Isaac inscribed in its arm. And he also has, I think, inscribed in his arm, kind of like a tattoo, a warning, except it's not a tattoo. I mean, it's like literally carved in his arm, like he'd etched it there. And it says, hell exists. And it's such an eerie introduction to a story that just gets eerier and eerier. And yes, what happens is, of course, inevitably, they try to find a passage through the cave system that leads below the mountain and onto the other side of this mountain, which presumably would have blocked the storm, and they're hoping to be able to survive by making a pass underground rather than trying to face the elements that had snuck up on them in this storm. They enter the cave, and of course, they never come back. Well, all but one, Ike, the leader of the expedition who does manage to escape. But of course, he is forever changed. He is changed by those who he meets down within the earth. Now, if you haven't read the book, I'm not going to say anything else. It does involve Hadals, but you've really got to read it. And it is an absolutely fabulous, fabulous book. One of my all-time favorite. And it's not really so much a horror novel, honestly. It's not like Salem's Lot or something like that. This book is so much more than that. And I would almost, you know, kind of liken it to the Da Vinci Code, because it gets a little into religion, it gets a little bit into mythology, and it gets extremely into almost Shaver-esque mysteries. Remember the Shaver mystery? Well, when we talk about these Hollow Earth stories, the idea has always compelled me, and I read The Descent years ago. I still will buy that book from time to time and give it to people as a gift because it's just so interesting. And keeping in mind that the author, Jeff Long, had actually been, if I remember correctly, a mountain guide. And he had done exactly what he discusses there in the book, which is interesting for a whole different set of reasons. But when I initially read that, I became kind of compelled by the idea. Because, you know, what inspires a writer to write a book where proto-human monsters, for lack of a better term, that exist underground begin interacting with humans, sometimes in horrific ways, as are described in that book? I always wonder, what is the inspiration for authors who want to write a book like that? You know, have they read about claims of encounters with things underground? Was he familiar with the Shaver mystery, the idea of the Darrows and the Taros, or what we might call theories, loose theories that Sasquatches run around in caves underground? You know, I don't take all that seriously, but it's interesting. Interesting enough, I think, for those who have an open mind. And so I, at one point, going against some advice given to me a long time ago, which was that if you go looking for evil, or you go looking for danger, or you go looking for the dark, it will usually, more often than not, find you. Or, maybe to paraphrase another term, what you seek is seeking you. A friend said that to me recently, and I kidded with them, oh, really? Well, then, I guess I should be expecting a visit from the Men in Black any day now, right? Now, in doing so, I think that that's something probably that has pushed me for years. Why do I search for the unexplained? Well, because obviously it's driven me a lot more towards skepticism, primarily, if anything. But I'm still driven to find those things that fascinate me, and I think on a fundamental level, that terrify me. And so I began to dig into whether or not there were literal reports that were in any way verifiable, or at very least that seemed, you know, somewhat credible regarding to people's supposed encounters with things from underground. And there are a lot of Hollow Earth conspiracies and things about reptilians, and really just, I think, a lot of silly garbage out there, made up stories that people tell from time to time. But there was one story I remember that I came across. I don't know what the hell to make of it, but it is one that is stuck out in my memory. And I thought, in the ancient tradition of gathering around the campfire and telling a tale, this one might be of interest as we approach the crisp autumn season. The story was told by a gentleman who, in the American Midwest, he'd been growing up, and he had had stories among his family of, I guess, for lack of a better term, a thing that had been seen in this particular little municipality. And he said that there had been stories more recently that children had told of some sort of a large something that was being seen in this forest that was located behind a fence. There was this large stretch of forest that connected with another area, another wilderness area. And this was in this forested area that was immediately accessible through a fence that was located behind a convenience store in this town. Well, the guy said, I was just a teenager, and I, riding my bike along with my girlfriend, rode over We rode over together, and I told her, I said, I'm going to go into the woods here, and I'm convinced this is a big white dog these kids are seeing. Well, he had his girlfriend drop him off, and he said, you know, you take the bike back over there, and I'll be back in 30 minutes once I prove that this thing's a dog. And furthermore, if it's a domestic dog, you know, I'm going to grab it by its collar and lead it back over here, and I'm going to prove to all these little dummies that there was nothing in the woods all along. We don't believe in monster stories. Not in our modern day, at least. Well, he says, I began walking through the woods, and it was getting dark, but not quite dark. Obviously, I could see well, but I expected fully that within a few minutes, this dog that these kids had been reporting in the area for the last few days, and even maybe in the last few hours, I was convinced I'd find the dog, and I would bring it over and become something of a town hero. So I'm walking along this particular trail, and I kind of break into a jog. I think I hear something over my right shoulder, and as he looks over, he sees nothing. Well, he begins jogging along again, and he becomes a little more apprehensive as he begins to think that he is indeed hearing the sound of something moving through the forest. But he says it doesn't sound like something walking on two legs. No, this certainly sounds like something moving, not quite like a dog, but it's not on two legs. He becomes appraised shortly thereafter of movement off to his right, and several yards off through the forest, he does indeed see some sort of movement, some sort of a light color. And he presumes, okay, this must be the dog. Little else it could be, right? And it certainly was not something moving upright. And as he's jogging along, he says the thing, he doesn't try to call to it. He at first wants to kind of see what is actually moving through the forest near him. And he says that over this little ridge, suddenly the thing becomes very apparent to him. He says that it looks like a man, but he says there's no hair on its body, and it's not wearing clothing. Some sort of a very pale man crawling on all fours very quickly. He said, at first I was absolutely terrified, but you think at first when you see something like that, is there somebody who's injured? What's going on? My gosh. He says that I begin to run again and that the thing still crawling on all fours is trying to keep pace with him from several yards away. And he says he's terrified, but as he moves along, this whatever this thing is keeping pace with him, moving on all fours, and that he says he stops at one point and looks back to see the thing and that it stops as well and looks at him. He says that there's no apparent eyes on the face, but he says that there's just this kind of a blank face, and the thing looks at him and in English says his name. Well, he takes off running, and he's convinced at this point that this was no dog. The description sounds ever so slightly like that of something that was once called in cryptozoological circles the Dover Demon. And in fact, interestingly, that name, I believe, coined by cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman. It was Coleman himself who had actually commented on a posting about this story on the website CryptoMundo.com, for which he wrote at the time. And when Lauren commented, this is all he had to say about this story. He wrote, not cryptozoology. The story did have some rather strange elements. In addition to this quote-unquote creature apparently saying this young boy's name, he said, I'm a grown man now and I've struggled my entire life to understand what this thing was. There were a few other times that we saw it. He said that on other occasions it didn't run on all fours, whatever this thing was, which was a little shorter than the average man, but still fairly tall. He said it would run upright from time to time, but that it would leave its arms dangling down at its sides in an awkward, clumsy way as it ran along. And he said that there were numerous encounters and that he thought in some way that this thing either knew who he was or was able to communicate because he said it had said his name. But he said that the thing had strange, almost ghastly pale skin, and because of that, he could only determine that whatever this thing was that he had seen, whether it be something spiritual, whether it be some sort of a strange monster from underground, he said indeed, the pale skin seemed to betray the fact that it had never spent much time in daylight and that it had to be some sort of a creature that lived beneath the earth. Sounds an awful lot like something maybe out of Edda Dorfa, though, to me, which maybe we'll pick up on just a little bit in the next segment. Make of that story what you will. We'll be right back. from a cave beneath Appalachia. Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks. On one of those nights where it's maybe not quite so friendly being down here in the hollow earth. You know, I am alone. And it's always a little odd when you're sitting in a cave underground, known to have been inhabited by proto-humans. And you're telling stories about that very subject. One of my very favorites. Something we don't talk about very often on the program. At least at length. But we were discussing in that last segment this story. It appeared at various times and places online, and as cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman had said, he really didn't think it was a good representation of cryptozoology. Now, what is cryptozoology? And more importantly, what was this thing, this creature? Well, I want to actually point out that, again, cryptozoology, the study of animals as yet unrecognized by science, it is not always viewed as just pure quackery. In fact, there was a good article, an introduction to cryptozoology that appeared online. It's actually, I believe, in some way associated with an institute of higher learning, more specifically Utah Valley University. That's the website where it actually appears. It was authored by Danny B. Stewart, and it's titled, again, An Introduction to Cryptozoology. But he argues cryptozoology is a legitimate scientific field worthy of the same level of attention and respect that any other science is allotted. He says, cryptozoology is the science of hidden animals, animals whose existence is known by the local populations sufficiently well that we indirectly know of their existence and certain aspects of their behavior and appearance. Perhaps a better term is animals undescribed by science. In this paper, he writes, I will show with example and historical precedent through evidence and the discovery of creatures that at one point were thought to be extinct or myths but were eventually proven to exist. I will attempt to prove that cryptozoology is a legitimate scientific field worthy of the same level of attention and respect that any other science allotted. And I think that within those jurisdictions that, yes, the serious study of animals that may exist, maybe even in some circumstances humanoids, maybe that is something worth considering. Yes, in fact, I wholeheartedly think it is. And which is why, of course, Lauren Coleman and many others in the field are, they're not derisive, but they are certainly people who want to say, if we're going to take seriously the scientific study of animals believed to exist but as yet unproven by science, we cannot get out there into loosey-goosey theories about other dimensions and all kinds of things like that. We've got to try and prove that there is a tangible phenomena. Where we're talking about animals that appear to be animals, I think that there's a good case to be made for this being tangible phenomena and thus being studied as tangible phenomena. And hence, I think, also vindicating the statements made by Lauren Coleman and others. By the same token, I think that with the UFO phenomena, as Jacques Vallée and others who are very science-minded have suggested, perhaps there is enough to this phenomena that is strange, or at least apparently so, that it warrants consideration that there is some sort of a component to this that extends beyond the purely physical as we as humans are capable of discerning it. Now stay with me here, because the idea, again, that we apply one modality of research to a certain field and then a different modality altogether to another field in seemingly related areas of interest, i.e. cryptozoology and ufology, may seem counterintuitive to some people. But again, I think that while we are obviously dealing with tangible aircraft in a lot of UFO cases, there are from time to time strange phenomena associated with this that seem to question, or beg the question, I should say, whether there's something else related to all this, something else happening that we don't fully understand just yet. We have to give consideration to that, I think, as Jacques Vallée attempts to do in a very reasonable scientific manner. He does not always succeed. He has been criticized, I think, for lapses in logic at times. Lapses in logic, funny to equate with this conversation, being that he is, of course, an information computer scientist. But, you know, I've even taken issues with some of Dr. Vallée's estimations in the past. And that's okay because, again, I've said this many times, science, real science, seeks to disprove, which is, again, why I gravitate more toward a skeptical disposition on all this. I do not debunk. I do not debunk for the sake of debunking. I do not make up stories so that I can debunk somebody else's claims, like I have noted in the past, just last week, in fact, that other debunkers have been guilty of doing at times. But something that I certainly do is I certainly give credence to ideas while trying to maintain a skeptical outlook. And that way I think I can keep my brain from falling out of my head when I examine subjects that otherwise may strain credulity. And at times they do. But again, I think that with regard to cryptozoology, we really need a more bare-bones kind of a physical approach than sometimes is called for with ufology. But we should not just say that, well, because ufology seems to be a little less to the point, physical, what have you, that we should rule out regular physical examination of that or a physical approach to the study of that science. Now, that said, I think that with regard to these reports of things living underground, that also seems rather counterintuitive, especially when these things purportedly crawl up out of holes, you know, crawl on all fours, run around in the forest, and say people's names. Now, this story, again, is related by this individual that it appeared online in numerous places. He'd posted it, I think, on the cryptozoology forums. He'd posted it at cryptomundo.com. You know, a lot of people had commented on it at the time, but there was never any real solid justification for the story. In other words, I couldn't tell you whether that's true. And frankly, it sounds so far out there to me that I don't know what to make of it. If you've heard this story before, or if you know where it still may be found online, presumably cryptomundo.com would have it. But if you happen to come across this story and you find it, I'd love to hear from you. And of course, the email is there on the website, so you're welcome to send that along to me. But the creature described in the story reminded me an awful lot. Even though it makes for a fun Halloween story, it reminds me an awful lot of a humanoid creature that appears in a book that was titled Edadorpha. Now, that is a very strange book. This book had been written back, I believe, in 1895 by a science fiction writer named Jean-Yuri Lloyd. He was actually something of a pharmaceutical manufacturer. And as a matter of fact, one of the theories about the strange and bizarre ideas put forth in this book had been that due to his work in the pharmaceutical industry, that perhaps some of the visions he had were actually drug-induced and maybe not wholly imaginary. But there's never been, to my knowledge, any proof of that. Now, the word Edadorpha is actually Aphrodite spelled backwards. And the full title of the book is Edadorpha or the End of the Earth, The Strange History of a Mysterious Being and the Account of a Remarkable Journey. Now, the mysterious being, of course, that we discuss here is a creature, I think I would call it, that is referred throughout the novel as I Am the Man, or sometimes it is called also the Man Who Did It. Now, to summarize this all briefly, essentially what happens is the first chapter of the book begins with the narrator who apparently, it begins with a preface, okay, that is actually signed by Jean-Yuri Lloyd himself. And it appears to kind of present this idea as a manuscript about three decades old that's been discovered, kind of like a found film that you see in the horror genre today. Well, in similar fashion, the idea here is that this was a manuscript and that Lloyd himself actually introduces it. The story was apparently dictated by this character who calls himself I Am the Man. And apparently the way that the story goes, I Am the Man tells Drury, Llewellyn Drury, about something that had happened some three decades beforehand. And in this story, what essentially happens is that the I Am the Man, as he calls himself, was suspected to be a threat to the secrecy of a secret society, some secret order, the members of which take him and they essentially give him to a cave. This cave is actually located in Kentucky, which is interesting for a number of reasons. Some people who kind of follow the mythology that surrounds cave-dwelling creatures and monsters from the inner earth, you may already be familiar with why, but there are a lot of tie-ins there. We'll touch on those a little bit later. And in the story, essentially what happens, I'm the Man is taken to this cave, and he's led down into this cave by a cavern dweller on what ends up being this drawn-out kind of subterranean journey that is both spiritual as it is an actual trip into the inner earth, i.e. your journey to the center of the earth or your Dante's Inferno. It's kind of a mix between the two. But this cave dweller is very interesting because the description of the cave dweller in the book, basically a very pale-skinned, hairless individual, no signs of sexual organs outwardly, and of course there's no eyes on this thing because it, you know, essentially lives underground, right? I mean, it's kind of like a blind cave salamander. But I always wondered how many of these representations of the inner earth dweller mythos, how many of them actually were inspired by Edadorpha, this initial story. And it's very interesting because a lot of people think that this story, which is, you know, very strange, you know, for a number of reasons, actually was inspired by pseudoscientific theories of the day back in the 1890s that the earth might literally be hollow. It's really kind of difficult to understand exactly what's going on there, but it was a book that was, you know, very popular. I mean, you still find it from time to time. As a matter of fact, purportedly Edidorfa had even become a name that became popular for infant girls around the time of the publication of the book, which I think went through some 18 different printings or so. It's actually still in print today, though. You can actually find it. I think Timothy Beckley, who with Global Communications has offered a lot of literature with regard to the Shaver mystery and underground mysteries, I think he even republished an edition of Edidorfa. But you can do a search for it online, and just if you look, you'll see these images, and you'll see this representation of this cave dweller thing. I think that this is probably somewhat related to a lot of these myths, because that sounds so much like these kinds of creatures that appear from time to time. Even the film representations of the Hadals in the Descent film were an awful lot like that, just not as friendly as the cave dweller that took I Am the Man on his journey down into the Hollow Earth. But when we hear these stories about reported creatures that exist underground, you know, it's interesting that Kentucky always comes back around into this, right? There was an article that our buddy Greg Newkirk over at the WhoFortedBlog.com website featured. And the article, it really caused quite a splash at the time. It appeared on June 20th of the year 2012. In the months leading up to the first Paradigm Symposium, I remember the Anomalist saying that this was, quote, one of the hot stories of the summer. As it flashed across the Anomalist news desk, it had really, really evoked a lot of interest. And it was, well, I'll just read the headline to you. Have the Kentucky Goblins returned? And it purported to show exclusive photographs that did seem to depict some sort of a strange, light-colored, humanoid-esque something, along with footprints of the reported animal. But what was even more interesting is that it was so similar, this series of events as it unfolded, to what had happened way back in 1955 up there around Hopkinsville and Cali. You remember the story of the Kelly Hopkinsville encounter, or the Hopkinsville Goblins case, the story of alleged goblins that appeared and had actually terrorized a family over the course of an evening. The story is very well known. Many kind of lump it in with ideas of extraterrestrial visitation. There were reports on the night back in 1955 of this alleged attack on this family when they holed up inside their house. They fought these things over the course of the evening. They even fired a gun at them. I think that in one of the more interesting descriptions of these goblins, that as they shot their shotgun at one of the Hopkinsville goblins, this little thing, this little silvery dwarf with long ears and big eyes, bug eyes might be a more effective rendering of the description, that the thing rolled in a circle backwards and then drifted off up into the air and kind of flew back up into a tree. I mean, these things defied all explanation. And it was really so far out there that people had said, were the family hallucinating? The whole thing just been made up? This is just too good to be anything remotely akin to being true. Well, it's been posited that perhaps the creatures were actually a hallucination, that it could have been mass hysteria. People have said the same thing about some of those famous hole-in encounters that we have with the skunk apes, as represented probably most famously toward the end of the film, The Legend of Boggy Creek. And there's a lot of conflicting opinions about that story. But whatever was happening there in Hopkinsville back in 1959, the family seemed very, very legitimately concerned. The reports from that era seem to indicate that there had been, at least in their minds, belief that something terrible was happening there on the property, that their lives were actually in utter danger, and that they had to defend themselves. And in ufological lore, it has always been looked at as being evidence, perhaps, of alien visitation. And yet, the fundamental question we have to ask about these alien visitations, or the belief in them, is there's a lot of variety from report to report of what these alleged beings look like. What's the reason for all the variety? Why? How can we account for that? So often people sit down to me and they say, why do you think the Greys are here? Micah, why do you think the Greys are visiting us? And I have to always say, well, first of all, what evidence do we have of Greys visiting Earth? I know that there's a lot of abductee lore out there. And as I've mentioned earlier, I mean, there are even certain books I recommend on that subject. It's obviously a part of the subculture that is related to all that we discuss here. If we're talking about UFOs, I've always said abductions, or at least descriptions of events consistent with abductions, can seem to occur with or without a UFO. And we have to take that into consideration, but there are also a lot of purported abductions that occur shortly after an object is seen descending from the sky. There were, apparently, reports of a large reddish-colored saucer that were seen in the area of the Hopkinsville incident on the very same night that the alleged attack occurred. But when people come to me and they say, what do you believe the reason for the grays and their presence is? I say, you know, really, we can't say that every case of abduction is really accurately represented by encounters with these so-called grays. I think it's a modern myth that people like to kind of append to the UFO phenomenon, that these grays are always the ones that are seen. You know, in my book, The UFO Singularity, I talked about a number of cases that seem to involve humans. Many more times in the past, I've discussed this on this program, where what's the weird situation, whatever it is that's going on, where people report seeing people on board these craft. Now, what was seen in Hopkinsville that night, these things certainly weren't people, if they were indeed seen. But I think that the important thing that we have to remember here is that the variety that is presented in the purported UFO contactee culture and lore, that cannot be overlooked. And whether or not that dissuades us from believing that there is a clear, coherent kind of a consistency between reports, or that maybe shows us that there's just, you know, a lot less to it altogether and that people are imagining things, you know, interpret it how you will. We don't seem to have enough good data, really, to be able to make those kinds of determinations. But with the Kelly-Hopkinsville encounter, yet again, if this is what people perceive as being a UFO contactee story, these things are not really consistent with other reports. And many of the famous cases are entirely inconsistent with one another. If you look at Hopkinsville and you compare that story alongside the story of Charles Hixon and Calvin Parker and their purported abduction in 1973, if you look at cases like that of Travis Walton, where he describes these diminutive-looking little grays, but then later, of course, meets humans that are the epitome of their gender. You know, we talk about Michelin men. We see robots. We see dwarves wearing capes. We see humans that have what is described as an Eastern appearance or very dark skin, like they've been tanning all summer. We even have reports of hairy hominids in conjunction with UFO cases. And so you can't tell me that there's one singular phenomena here, or at very least that if there is one singular UFO phenomena and that these reports of humanoids cited alongside them are accurate representations of what people claim to have seen, that these are all one singular variety of quote-unquote aliens or humanoids, you know, that just does not seem to be the case. And frankly, we see a lot less in terms of reports of quote-unquote aliens than we did a few decades ago. That has changed, and we have to acknowledge that. So what do we make of these cases like that of the Hopkinsville goblins? Well, what's interesting is that, of course, this seems to have taken place in Kentucky and in conjunction with these reports of what? You're right, caves. And one of the things that had been speculated around the time when Greg Newkirk put this case up, the story was really kind of funny, actually. It all went back to this ghost hunting group that he had, and he'd gotten an email at his former address, ghosthuntersinc@gmail.com. The email had been sent by a gentleman who called himself David, probably wasn't David Wilcock, for those of you wondering. And he says, "Hello, my name is David. I received your contact information through a mutual acquaintance who assures me that you are well-equipped to investigate peculiar problems. Furthermore, I believe you may have interest in these events beyond any compensation that I'm prepared to deliver in order to have these issues sorted." Now, David described ongoing encounters with strange little diminutive humanoids on his property. He describes this to Greg, and he says, "I've been living in a rural home located on the border of West Virginia and Kentucky, where my family is nightly assaulted by creatures that I have come to believe are an extraterrestrial variety. These beings appear to be the size and stature of a small child, devoid of any facial features save for large oily eyes and lipless mouths. They frighten my children by peering through their bedroom windows, chirping at one another. They actively attempt to enter my home in the middle of the night. Last month, they took my dog. The police refused to provide any further assistance, attributing the problems to wild animals and forwarding my complaints to the State Game Commission. Now, I believe that they are coming from an abandoned mine located on the edge of my property. Though I'm armed, I'm afraid that I'm far too frightened to enter the mine by my lonesome and cannot convince any sympathetic friends to accompany me, though I cannot blame them. I'm convinced that the only answer is to collapse the mind. I believe this is where we can be mutually beneficial to one another," David wrote to Greg. "If you're prepared to assist me in this matter, I can offer you permission to record and document these events under the condition of anonymity. I can guarantee you evidence of these creatures, which I assure you are not wild animals. Please respond ASAP, and thank you." Well, Greg did respond, and he did receive further correspondence. But he'd asked exactly what had led David, the author of the email, to Greg's attention. And he said, "I was given your contact information through a man by the name of Terry Rist. When these disturbances first began occurring, I was only inclined to confide in a personal friend who I knew had fringe interests. He offered to share my concerns with a man that had dealt with somewhat similar experiences in previous years. I accepted his offer, and within a week I was informed that this gentleman had long since retired from pursuits of this kind, but was willing to provide me with contacts who may be willing to help. And this is how I came to contact you. I do not have any answer to why other than a referral and a recommendation from a gentleman I do not know personally. I was under the impression that you would answer that question." He says, "I'm located in Pike County, just outside the town of," he redacted that from the email, but it wasn't Kentucky. "It's located 30 to 60 minutes from the borders of Virginia and West Virginia, respectively. Most of Pike County is made up of small towns and rural communities. It is not uncommon to go days without seeing my closest neighbors. I moved to this area for the peace and the quiet, and I've received neither." Well, the story went on, and it became very, very strange, of course. He related that his dogs, of course, were from time to time apt to chase after him, become frightened by these things. His children, in fact, his 5-year-old daughter had begun to talk about the kids without hair that had become prone to peer in the windows, especially late in the evening. They discovered things like wreaths that hung around the rear porch had been stuffed into their mailbox, and other weird things happening on the property. Motion-activated floodlights would come on at night, and yet there would be no animal or any sign of anything that might have triggered them. He said, "I was awoken to the sound of my daughter screaming and rushed to her bedroom one evening, only to meet her halfway down the hall. When my wife and I were finally able to calm her down enough to speak, she told us that the kids, the hairless kids, were trying to peer in her window, but that they couldn't reach, and instead had taken to tapping on it. She hasn't slept in her own bedroom since. It was that morning that I phoned the police," David wrote, "for the second time, and they responded by finally sending a trooper to our residence. I informed him of the regular mischief, how I was now unable to let my dog outdoors after dusk, and of the bald kids that seemed to enjoy terrorizing us at night. When we found the ground disturbed just under my daughter's bedroom window, the officer informed me very matter-of-factly that we were dealing with an animal, not little bald kids, and I would be better off contacting the game commission than wasting their resources any further." Well, the story kept getting weirder and weirder and weirder, and of course, rather tongue-in-cheek, Greg had announced the foundation of what he called the Alien Cave Base Task Force. And here in the Graylian bunker, I had become appraised of this and offered to Greg that if they did indeed decide to go down into a mine in Kentucky in search of little bald kids who were terrorizing the family of this man, that I would, well, of course, naturally, volunteer my own services. Apparently, little did I know that our good friend John Wilson, also who provides for the Daily and Grayly News from time to time, had also offered to join the Alien Cave Base Task Force, and we became members of this tongue-in-cheek organization. Now, that said, the story began to get weirder and weirder because later Greg was contacted purportedly by the Terry Rist character, who he found out later, of course, had been a pseudonym that was used by an ex-military occultist interviewed in a book by Alan H. Greenfield titled Secret Cipher of the UFOnauts. Now, when he was contacted himself by Terry Rist, he received something along the lines of a message that he posted subsequently on Facebook, Greg Newkirk. And the message read, "Why give up when you were so close?" Well, there were other messages, and they bore a stark similarity to a particular kind of mystery message that I had been interested in a number of years ago. And if you head over to the website johnkeel.com, a website maintained by Doug Skinner, who had been a longtime friend of John Keel, you'll actually see there at the website that there are a number of harassing kind of letters that Keel had received, and Doug Skinner, having retrieved these from the archives that Keel kept, and now, of course, which are in the possession of Doug Skinner, he has posted a lot of these online, and there were entire newsletters that John Keel had written over the years with segments that were dedicated to the discussion of what they called anomalous letters, letters of harassment that would be received from time to time by 4TN researchers. Some of the ones that Keel featured were particularly unnerving because they would arrive in what looked like military or colored U.S. Army envelopes, but they'd have no return address. They'd have strange things like that, and yet they would end up in his mailbox. Where could they have come from? And they would have strange things, like, for instance, my favorite of all time, which we may have discussed at least once or twice in the past on the program, but my favorite had been addressed to Keel, and it had this very elegant and elaborate-looking letterhead that read the International Bankers, and it warned Keel that those who went asking too many questions about the UFO subject might end up following in the unhealthy footsteps of the likes of Morris Jessup, Albert Bender, and others who came close to knowing too much. Now, John Keel, of course, perceived these things as warnings, but I don't think that he ever took them too terribly seriously, and he probably believed, if anything, that these were evidence of hoaxes that were being perpetrated against him by the likes of Gray Barker and maybe even Jim Moseley, who passed away a couple of years ago. Moseley, some of you may remember, had been the author and the man behind the saucer smear and was well regarded in UFO circles up until his death. But Moseley and Barker and a lot of those guys seemed to kind of have, I don't know, an affinity for confusion and for spreading jokes and misinformation at times, and Keel seemed to think that a lot of these harassing letters were from guys like that. But a few of the things that would often appear in the anomalous letters were, in addition to harassments and vague threats, dark tones, imagery, and references to secret societies, international bankers, and all kinds of globalist conspiracies and the like, one of the things that they would often show was in the text, and otherwise well-presented and well-written text, there would be what appeared to be careless or maybe even intentional misspellings, the likes of which also appeared in the letters received by Greg Newkirk. But to me, the strangest element to this entire weird affair didn't come to light for another few months or so. And right after the Paradigm Symposium in 2012, Greg and his wife and a couple of his associates, Nick and Jason from Who Forded, they came down. They were filming a documentary, and they wanted to film a portion of this at Brown Mountain. And so I got to actually meet Greg and hang out with he and his companions. And we went to Brown Mountain, and I took them in some caves for this documentary, and we discussed a lot of this stuff. It was after he was at Brown Mountain he got the message, "Why did you give up when you were so close?" And subsequently, another correspondent offered an image that seemed to have a series of numbers after the fact. And Greg said, "When I plotted the numbers as latitude and longitude, they showed one singular location on the map, which could not be denied. It was Brown Mountain or the Linville Gorge area in North Carolina, where you and I, Micah, had been just a few months ago." So what is it about Brown Mountain that's so interesting? Well, you know what the theories are out there, of course. We've discussed this on the program. People have even written into me, especially following the popularity of Maddie Beckerman's film Alien Abduction, with clarification about certain allegations that have been made. And one of those is that there is some sort of an underground facility beneath Brown Mountain. Now, I've heard those legends for years, and I couldn't confirm that for you. I couldn't tell you in good faith that I think that there is an underground base beneath the Linville Gorge. But unlike other parts of Western North Carolina, I'll tell you what there certainly is to be found beneath the Linville Gorge and beneath the Brown Mountain area. As a matter of fact, on the way up to Wiseman's View, the road that winds its way up the mountain there and brings you up to what eventually is Wiseman's View, one of my very favorite viewing spots of the Brown Mountain Lights, as you're driving up the road and you're headed up to Linville Falls, up what I guess is US 441 coming up out of Marion, you're going to pass on your left what's called Linville Caverns. That's right, there is a rather elaborate cavern system down at the base of the mountain just below Linville Falls, the little town which is nearest to Wiseman's View, which of course is very popularly associated with the Brown Mountain Lights and viewing them from that location, because from there you can see, as I've discussed also in the past, Table Rock, you can see Hawksbill, and then off in the distance between the two you can actually see the ridge of Brown Mountain. And in truth, there are probably more reports that come from up there at Linville Falls around Wiseman's View than there are across the gorge and over at 181, which is the nearest highway to Brown Mountain itself. And so here, Brown Mountain, the purported site of some alien underground base. Again, I don't buy that, but I know that there are elaborate cave systems, and at least some of the entrances to caves I've actually taken Greg and some of the people into. And he gets this message, and there seems to be some sort of a continuation of this mythology surrounding Brown Mountain, the Linville Gorge, the idea of alien cave bases. Who the hell knows what's going on? Sometimes, deep, deep within my soul, I wonder if there aren't just troops of individuals out there who are dedicated maybe to nothing more than just trying to obfuscate, maybe just trying to cloud the already clouded waters of Fortiana to try and confuse and to try and manipulate researchers. And they use strange names, or they borrow names that have appeared in other literature maybe beforehand, several decades beforehand at that. Who knows really what elements lurk beneath? But I think that sometimes part of the confusion arises from the mythology itself and those who, more than wanting to find an actual phenomenon, are searching from the monsters that have been built around the myth over the decades. I couldn't tell you if that's what these reports of cave monsters actually entail, or why guys like Greg Newkirk and I get drug into all of it, but I'll tell you, it does certainly hold one's fascination over time, doesn't it? That's going to wrap up another edition of this program you've come to know and love as the Grailian Report. We'll talk to you subscribers later in the week on Grailian X. And in the meantime, on behalf of all of us here at the Grailian Report, Matthew Oakley, Caleb Hanks, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, we bid you adieu. And as always, my dear friends, stay strange and stay warm out there as the cool air begins to creep upon us. We'll be hearing from more creeps that come in with the cold in the coming weeks, and we'll talk to you again very soon.
Listening to the Grailian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Grailian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GrailianReport.com.